infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
Why don't you ask me what it feels like to be a freak?
Greetings, and you're listening to Savage Science Radio here at Jackalope 105 FM, and I'm your host, Tracy Savage. Let's get some music to start tonight off just right.
You
Well, hello there. I hope you're awake, because it's time to dive right into the Atom and Cosmos news. A galactic close encounter? Well, the Milky Way may have had one. Some 1.75 billion years ago, a smaller galaxy swung by our neck of the cosmic woods, smearing out the Milky Way stars in a gravitational tug of war. Now, the astronomers have simulated this galactic close encounter in the best detail yet and suggest that it may have formed the Milky Way's dramatic spiral arms. Small galaxy interactions could thus play a bigger role in shaping galaxies than previously thought, writes Chris Purcell of the University of Pittsburgh and the University of California, Irvine, and his colleagues in the September 15th issue of Nature, so you can check that out. And putting the squeeze on gravitational waves? Well, making a deal with the quantum devil may help researchers detect gravitational waves, which are hypothetical ripples in the fabric of space-time caused by supernovas, black holes, and other massive accelerating objects. These ripples are so slight that they can be hidden by random quantum fluctuations in the laser beams designed to detect them. But squeeze light, which is an unusual state that trades certainty about light's amplitude for certainty about its phase, can suppress this randomness. Adding squeezed light to the GEO-600 detector near Hanover, Germany, reduced noise in the detector, improving its sensitivity to high-frequency gravitational waves by more than a factor of 3. Researchers estimated this online September 11th in Nature Physics. One more cool thing to check out right there. And primitive galaxies glow blue. Well, the university's first galaxies may glow with an identifiable blue light. These galaxies should contain exemplars of the first population of stars, those made of only hydrogen and helium. Such stars produce a great deal of energy capable of ionizing hydrogen, but the resulting blue-tinged emission tends to be lost in a dusty intervening material. Swedish and Japanese astronomers now suggest September 9th on arxiv.org that this emission can actually be spotted by the Hubble Space Telescope, allowing astronomers to identify the first galaxies in the early universe. Indeed, they note objects have already been sighted that match their criteria. Ooh, that's pretty cool. So you can check it out on that site. And a 21st century Gemini mission? Well, NASA's latest lunar explorers, the Grail mission's twin spacecraft, took to the heavens on September 11th. As they zoom around the moon in a shared orbit, the twins will measure the moon's gravity and interior structure. Mountains, craters, and subterranean masses all tug slightly on the craft and vary the distance between them. Now, instruments capable of detecting changes in the separation of the pair as small as the width of a red blood cell, that little, will use these fluctuations to create the gravity map. Can hardly wait to see what that looks like. And the black holes blocked well. Speaking of black holes, which we just were a minute ago, the supermassive black holes are notorious light killers. There may be another reason that they're hard to see. The fractured remnants of comets and asteroids that once lived near the black holes form a dusty debris disk that's hard to see through. These terrestrial bodies create a super Oort cloud lurking near active galactic nuclei. A team of astronomers suggested this in a paper posted online September 6th at arxiv.org. Areas surrounding the dark feisty feasters are known to be metal-rich, fertile, star-forming grounds. The team suggests that giant planets and terrestrial bodies might also take shape near the vortex. As these smaller bodies collide, they could produce the occluding cloud. And speaking of supernovas, which we just were like a minute ago, also, we have a little bit of a surprise. PTF-11KLY, which is the recently discovered Type 1A supernova, is already changing what scientists know about these types of stellar explosions, which result from overstuffed white dwarf stars. After searching the archival Hubble Space Telescope images, astronomers were unable to find the supernova progenitor's mugshot. Now, a team suggests in a study posted to arxiv.org, also a busy little site, on September 7th that the star was 10 to 100 times fainter than expected. Now, this means that the white dwarf's companion, you know, the star it stole matter from until it popped, was almost certainly not a regular middle-aged star. Instead, scientists think the dwarf may have been joined by a second dwarf or small cool star. News, we have a few interesting stories, like catching a natural killer in the act. Well, microscopic images of disease-fighting cells may one day help treat immune deficiency disorders. Jordan Orange of the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and his colleagues used a super powerful new microscope to watch how immune cells called natural killer cells feed a poison pill called a lytic granule to tumors or virus-infected cells. Scientists used to think that a big hole in the middle of a dense mesh of spaghetti-like molecules called F-actin let granules stream out of the natural killer cell, but the new study published online September 13th in PLOS Biology shows that the meshwork parts just enough to let the single lytic granules pass, with the F-actin helping squeeze the granule through. People with immune deficiency disorders may have defects that prevent lytic granules from exiting the natural killer cell. That's very interesting. Host genes determine how bad H5N1 infection gets. Well, as you can imagine, since it's an epidemic, the H5N1 avian influenza virus may get its killing power from its host. It hasn't been clear whether humans die from having lots of viruses in their lungs or from making too many inflammation-producing chemicals. Now researchers at St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee, and Roche Pharmaceutical in Palo Alto, California, have evidence from studies in mice that the victim's own genetic makeup determines how well the virus grows in the lungs. Genetically susceptible mouse strains had more viruses in their lungs than resistant strains, the team reported online September 6th in MBio. More viruses lead to more inflammation, too, they also said. And scientists have found a surprising new connection between the brain and the immune system. In two papers, both published online September 15th in Science, researchers show that important immune cells called T cells make the link. In one study, Kevin Tracy of the Feinstein Institute for Medical Research in Manhasset, New York, and international colleagues show that the vagus nerve sends signals to a subset of T cells that produce the chemical acetylcholine. Now, those T cells then help calm inflammation. And researchers at the University of Calgary in Alberta, Canada, show that strokes suppress the action of immune cells in the liver and spleen of mice, leading to weakened immune reactions. Both very interesting and have a lot of implications about how we stave off disease. And our brain, is it your friend or your foe? Well, your brain may be sabotaging your efforts to lose weight. The sight of food turns different parts of the brain on in lean versus obese people, this new study is finding. So in obese people, even when the brain knows the body isn't hungry, it responds to food as if it were, this new brain scan data shows. That means that when obese people try to shed weight, they might find themselves on the losing side of a battle with neural centers that unconsciously encourage them to eat. For instance, in normal weight people, a neural reward system that reinforces positive feelings associated with food turns off when the levels of the blood sugar glucose return to normal after a meal. This is a signal that the body's need for calories has been sated. But in obese people, that reward center in the central brain turns on at the sight of high-calorie food even when their blood sugar levels are normal. The new findings show that the regulatory role of glucose was missing in the obese, says Alyssa Eppel of the University of California, San Francisco, an obesity researcher not involved with this new study. However, she has some more interesting things to say. She says that the data might, quote, explain the drive to eat that some obese people feel despite how much they've eaten. Now, for this study, 9 lean and 5 obese adult volunteers viewed pictures of food such as ice cream, french fries, cauliflower, or a salad while undergoing brain scans. Throughout the procedure, researchers asked the recruits to rate their hunger and how much they wanted a particular item. Volunteers arrived for their brain scans several hours after eating, and the researchers used insulin pumps to establish volunteers' blood sugar levels at either normal background values, like which is roughly 90 milligrams per deciliter, or at the mild end of low, which would be around 70 milligrams per deciliter. Now, that low value can occur briefly in some people during the day, especially in people with diabetes or metabolic conditions that precede diabetes, notes the endocrinologist Robert Sherwin of Yale University, co-author of the new study. All volunteers reported wanting food, especially high-calorie fare, when the blood glucose was low. Sherwin's team reported this online September 19th, by the way, in the Journal of Clinical Investigation, if you want to look that up. Now, brain scans showed that parts of the brain that control reason and willpower, such as the prefrontal cortex, were relatively inactive when blood glucose was low, while regions that foster eating and offer the positive reinforcement turned on. For lean people, the opposite trend emerged when blood glucose was normal. The surprise, Sherwin says, was that that part of the brain that allows people to consciously exert willpower over food intake largely turns off in obese people. This suggests that, he says, their brain differences may perpetuate obesity. Though small, this study was so well designed and controlled that it, quote, lets us see some clean results in a relatively small cohort, says obesity scientist Diane Lattman of the Veterans Affairs Puget Sound Healthcare Systems in Seattle. Now, the research team's ability to discern differences in the desire for foods relative to body weight and based on a not too dramatic drop in blood sugar is, quote, extremely interesting, she adds. Now, the results pull together trends seen in animals and findings reported in more limited human trials. So you can check that out in the September 19th issue of the Journal of Clinical Investigation. And speaking of the brain also, ringing in the ears is also known as tinnitus, and it may have a deeper source resulting from the brain's effort to compensate for hearing loss in this new study. Now, the high-pitched ringing, squealing, hissing, clicking, roaring, buzzing, or whistling in the ears that can drive tinnitus sufferers crazy may be a byproduct of the brain turning up the volume to cope with subtle hearing loss, a new study has suggested. The results, published in the September 21st issue of Journal of Neuroscience, may help scientists understand how the condition arises. Tinnitus is clearly a disorder of the brain, not the ear, says study co-author Roland Chayette of the University of College London Ear Institute. One convincing piece of evidence, past attempts to cure the condition by severing the auditory nerve in desperate patients left people completely deaf to the outside world, but didn't silence the ringing. How the brain creates the maddeningly persistent phantom noise remains a mystery. Usually tinnitus is tied to some degree of measurable hearing loss, but not always. We've known for a long time that there are people who report tinnitus whose audiograms are normal, says auditory neuroscientist Larry Roberts of McMaster University in Canada. He wasn't involved in this study, but he says that it may be a puzzle to figure out these exceptions to the rule. Now, Chayette and co-author David McAlpine, who of the UCL Ear Institute, suggest that these exceptions may actually be due to hidden hearing loss that shirks detection in standard hearing tests. Now, the pair focused on the 10% of the people with tinnitus who seem to have normal hearing. The team recruited 15 women with chronic tinnitus and 18 women who were free of the condition, all of whom had normal hearing tests. The researchers used electrodes to record the brain's electrical activity as the subjects listened to loud, rapid-fire clicks. In the people with tinnitus, electrodes picked up a subtle abnormality in the brain's initial electrical response to the clicks, a signal generated then by the nerve fibers that carry sounds from the ear's cochlea to the brain was weakened, perhaps because of the damage to some of the fibers, they think. Now, this hard-to-detect hearing loss may be driving the tinnitus. A signal generated later in the sound-ear-brain pathway looked normal in people with tinnitus, the team found. In response to the loud clicks, electrical activity in the brainstem was no different between the two groups. In participants with tinnitus, the seemingly normal signal from the brainstem comes from the brain compensating for its hearing loss by boosting nerve cells' signal-sending activity in a way that doesn't depend on the external sounds, Chayette McAlpine had proposed. Now, it's this heightened and spontaneous nerve cell activity in the brainstem that leads to the phantom tinnitus sound, they reasoned. The brain cranks up the volume to make up for the pathologically low signal from the auditory nerve, exaggerating everything and creating tinnitus, Chayette says. The subtle hearing loss detected in the new study and is linked to tinnitus is cause for concern, says Roberts. It does suggest, and frankly, I think, very strongly suggest, that there is more hearing loss in the general population than we realize, he says. There is a looming public health risk here, and I think of considerable magnitude. So you can check that out. It's, of course, going to be an ongoing study. We're going to be bringing more on that story as it updates. I have it on my alerts. kind of news about life on this planet, all kinds of life, we have an interesting story about recently hatched, still blind honeyguide chicks, for the first time have been captured on video attacking and killing their nest mates. The tropical birds are cuckoo-like parasites laying their eggs in other species' nests and leaving the hapless foster parents to do the work of feeding the resulting honeyguide chick. Surprise! You have a new baby. On an egg-laying blitz, the mother honeyguide stabs the host eggs already in the nest, increasing the chances that the parasite chick gets all the foster parents' attention. Should a host egg hatch anyway, the honeyguide chick itself can make up for the mom's oversight, according to Claire Spottiswood of the University of Cambridge in England, and a colleague reported online September 7th in Biology Letters. Now, the young honeyguide, equipped with sharp spikes at its bill tip, grabs any new hatchling in a prolonged shaking bite that causes fatal internal bleeding. And they actually have a picture of this thing. One of these little blind babies hanging on to one of the researchers' fingers. It's crazy. Anyways, that report is September 7th in Biology Letters. Now, glowworms, another interesting little species, the intensity of a glowworm's eerie light is controlled in part by a particular nitrogen-containing compound called octopamine. Scientists at the University of Queensland in Australia have discovered. Now, the worms are carnivorous larvae of the fly Aflava. They dangle from cave ceilings like strings of luminescent beads. Evidence suggested that the worm's shine, which lures flying insects to a sticky death, was actively repressed during the day. Now, experiments that included feeding the glowworm flies laced with different compounds suggested that octopamine plays a central role in releasing the worm's light. The team reported this in the October 1st Journal of Experimental Biology. And what exactly is a snowball's chance? Well, life could have survived global deep freezes 600 million to 800 million years ago by taking refuge in a narrow inland sea, a new modeling study suggests. Thick ice periodically covered almost all the world's oceans during the so-called snowball Earth period, raising questions about how surface algae managed to survive. Now, a team at the University of Washington in Seattle has found that under certain conditions, ice would not have reached the end of a narrow inlet like the Red Sea, possibly allowing a last holdout of life to squeak through the cold times. The work will appear in an upcoming geophysical research letter, so we'll keep our eyes out for that. Male canaries, not usually known for social intelligence as yet, are smart enough not to flirt enthusiastically with other females when their mates are watching. Research in creatures as diverse as field crickets and guppies has already introduced the idea that audiences can matter to an animal. Now, aggressive behavior shifts according to who's watching, but less is known about male-female matters, say researchers at University of Paris Ouest Nanterre La Défense in France. Male canaries have adjusted their aggression depending on the audience, but also kept an eye out for the mate when flirting. The researchers reported this online August 9th in PLOS 1. And dinosaur-era feathers sealed in amber show pigment and fine details that have been preserved in this new collection that have been discovered. Bits of filaments and feathers were trapped in amber 79 million years ago, and they offer an unusually wide-ranging view of what late dinosaurs and early birds were wearing. The 11 small amber-bound specimens found in Canada span an evolutionary range of late Cretaceous fashion from what appear to be unbranched filaments, which have been proposed as the first stage of dinosaur feather evolution, to bits of sophisticated corkscrewy barbs like the wettable feathers on modern diving birds, a team from the University of Alberta reported in the September 16th issue of Science. Such a range has shown up squashed in rock fossils, but, quote, "we're seeing the same thing preserved in beautiful 3D forms," unquote, says co-author Ryan McKellar. It's preserved down to the point of having pigment, which opens up the doorway for all sorts of weird and wonderful investigations. Now, to find the 11 specimens, McKellar screened more than 4,000 pieces of amber collected from the discards of a coal mining operation near the town of Grassy Lake in southern Alberta. McKellar speculates that back in the day, the area was some kind of salt marsh along the edge of the Great Seaway that ran through what is today western North America. This trove of amber gives independent evidence that ancient feathers and even simple filaments indeed carried pigment, says evolutionary ornithologist Richard Prum of Yale University. Quote, I was stunned to see the level of detail preserved, he said. Now, how feathers evolved has roused heated debate in recent years, as compressed rock fossils of dinosaurs have turned up bearing what look like protofeathers filaments or fuzz. Well-preserved fossils such as Anchiornis even show feathers with complex branching. All but the most complicated asymmetrical flight feathers have shown up so far in dinosaurs, Prum notes. Simple filaments or clusters of filaments may have been early stages of feather evolution, unable to heave an animal off the ground, but possibly of use for insulation or courtship displays. Fancier structures that weren't flight capable may have been given an aerodynamic boost for animals rushing up steep slopes. A few fragments of ancient feathers or protofeathers have turned up in amber before, including bits from Lebanon, France, and New Jersey in the United States. But none of the previous finds from dinosaur times have shown the diversity of the newly described assemblage, McKellar says. Now, he and his colleagues have found not only what looks like unbranched filament, but what has been proposed as a possible second stage in feather evolution, a cluster of filaments. Prum ranks the second stage feathery bit as really great and convincingly identified, but admits nagging reservations on how definitively the simple filament can be linked to a dinosaur or bird instead of some other debris snagged in amber. A separate striking amber specimen shows a bird-like feather branching into secondary twigs or barbules, the hooklets like those in modern bird feathers that zip together side by side barbules to make a tight interlocked surface. You know, when you pull them apart, you can see how they work. Barbules on another specimen spiral at the base, a feature that allows the feathers' linked elements to loosen a bit when wet. Such feathers on a modern water bird ease diving by reducing trapped air, and they allow parents to soak their feathers in water and then ferry the drink back to chicks. None of the amber-trapped feathers had original owners attached, so the researchers can merely speculate that the simpler ones might be from dinosaurs and the more complicated structures from birds. It's really a neat cross-section of what had plumage during the late Cretaceous, said McKellar. McKellar is an invertebrate paleontologist and found the feather bits as part of a PhD project searching for tiny amber-encased wasps less than 3 millimeters long. Under the high-resolution scrutiny required to find the insects, miniature feather bits showed up too. Paleontologist Jacob Vinther of the University of Texas in Austin says he was pretty excited when he heard McKellar talk about the amber fossils. Vinther, who has identified microscopic pigment-bearing structures in fossil feathers, tried to persuade McKellar to give up some small bits of the specimens for examination by scanning electron microscope. But McKellar, who averaged a fine of 360 specimens or so, says he's not ready to sacrifice any of the samples just yet. We'll keep you tuned on that one. That's also on my alert. Very, very interesting. Also considering the fact that this debate has been raging for as long as I can remember about the whole feather thing, and especially in the last few years. So very cool, and I'll be looking for pictures of those, and I'll share those sites with you when I get them.
See you.
with all of the standing water that's back east left over from the recent storms, there's been some concern for mosquitoes, and a lot of people turn to DEET. But how does it actually work? Well, insect repellent DEET doesn't actually repel the insects, it confuses them. New research suggests that DEET gums up sniffing machinery, sabotaging an insect's sense of smell. Nerve cells that send odor-related signals to the brain respond differently to DEET if it's sniffed alone or with other scents, experiments with fruit flies have revealed. Now, DEET's effects may also vary depending on what variety of smell-receiving machinery catches the scent, and whether it's a whopping dose or just a whiff. This team of researchers have reported online September 21st in Nature. The effects of DEET are not straightforward, says neuroscientist Marizo Pellegrino of the University of California, Berkeley, a member of the research team. We think it confuses the odor coding. The insect doesn't know exactly what it's smelling. Well, the highly effective compound has been protecting people for decades from loathsome mosquitoes, ticks, and chiggers. It hasn't been clear how DEET does its stuff. As any little league parent or backyard barbecue chef knows, a mosquito that lands on a DEET-slathered arm takes off in a hurry. DEET also protects people before a bug makes contact. Some evidence has suggested that the compound hits a specific cellular baseball mitt, an odor receiver that catches repellent scents, triggering a get-the-heck-out-of-here signal. The idea was when an insect detected such an odorant, it would fly away. It didn't want any part of it, says Joseph Dickens of the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Invasive Insect Biocontrol and Behavior Laboratory in Beltsville, Maryland. But the new work suggests that DEET isn't repulsive or frightening to bugs. It's baffling, binding to them to the delicious scent of human. It's as if you are hungry and you love hamburgers, says Pellegrino, who did the work at Rockefeller University in New York City. If DEET is present, it doesn't smell like hamburger anymore, even if a hamburger is right in front of you. Fruit flies have more than 60 cellular mitts for catching scents. When the mixtures of molecules that make up odors drift by, the mitts snatch particular molecules, nerves fire, and an odor message is sent to the fly's brain. When the researchers exposed flies to DEET alone and combined with other scents, the nerves didn't fire in a consistent pattern. Changing up the concentration of DEET altered the nerve firing as well, Pellegrina and colleagues reported. The results suggest that DEET corrupts the odor signal, perhaps by contorting parts of the sniffing machinery in such a way that wafting molecules other than DEET are misinterpreted. Surveying the sniffing machinery of fruit flies from around the world revealed further evidence that DEET might render the fly's odor receivers incapable of catching other scents. One fruit fly strain, Boa Esperanza of Brazil, was insensitive to DEET, responding to scents as if DEET weren't even there. Wow, that's a tough one. A comparison of the proteins that make up the Brazilian strain sniffing machine revealed structural differences that may prevent DEET from being caught. And speaking of the environment, we have a little bit of news here. Plans by China and India to green their electricity generation could leave a very toxic footprint, a new study finds. U.S. researchers identified emissions rates for lead associated with mining, its use in batteries and battery recycling in China and other developing nations. Then the scientists applied those figures to the battery loads needed as energy storage to support the photovoltaic power goals of 1.6 gigawatts. Watts for China and 12 gigawatts for India within a decade. Achieving these targets would likely end up releasing almost 2,500 kilotons of lead into the nation's environments, the researchers reported in the September issue of Energy Policy. And as if volcanic eruptions weren't enough to worry about, scientists now say it's time to pay attention to volcanic landslides as well. Some 730,000 years ago, a volcano on Tenerife in the Canary Islands erupted, sending a debris avalanche downhill along with the gas and ash. For the next half million years, the presence of this debris pile helped channel the destructive force of later eruptions off to one side of the mountain. Hunting for similar ancient landslides at other volcanoes could improve hazard assessments, scientists from England and Denmark wrote in a paper published online September 2nd in Geology. And although major household appliances are energy hogs, they typically contribute no more greenhouse gas emissions to the environment than do a family's electronic equipment, researchers at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology in Trondheim found. Manufacturing electronic products can spew more greenhouse gases than generating the energy to power those devices throughout their lifetimes, the scientists reported online August 30th in Environmental Science and Technology. People also replace electronics far more frequently than big appliances. Quote, the rate of acquisition of new TVs and PCs need to be reduced, unquote. Authors Edgar Hurtwich and Charlotte Rue concluded, so you can look that up in the August 30th issue in Environmental Science and Technology for more statistics and their conclusions. And speaking of volcanoes, Pacific volcanoes share a split personality. Well, Hawaii's scenic volcanoes come in two chemical flavors, and now scientists think the igneous peaks on several other Pacific island chains do too. Two parallel, and I think we talked about this on a previous episode of Savage Science Radio, as a matter of fact, two parallel lines of volcanoes stretch from the Big Island of Hawaii in the southeast to Molokai in the northwest. Volcanoes on the Samoan and Marquesas Islands are similarly paired. A new study finds that, as in Hawaii, one row is richer than the other in versions of elements such as lead and neodymium. This might be a common feature for all Pacific hotspots, says Dr. Shichun Huang, a chemist at Harvard University and lead author of a paper appearing online September 18th in Nature Geoscience. If so, these island chains may tap the same source deep in Earth's mantle. Molten rock rises toward the surface in two chemically distinct streams, one stream feeding each row of volcanoes. Geologists think Hawaii, Samoa, and the Marquesas, each formed as a plate of Earth's crust, moved across a hot spot, the top of a plume carrying the molten material from the planet's deep interior. Like a welding torch passing across a piece of metal, the hotspot punched out island after island as the plate moved over it. Recent studies have shown that hotspots are more complex than once thought, says isotope geochemist Dominique Weiss of the University of British Columbia. The mantle plume rising below Hawaii for existence feeds individual streams of chemically distinct magmas into Mauna Loa and Mauna Kea, both on the Big Island. Mauna Loa has a higher ratio of the most abundant form of lead on Earth, lead-208, compared with lead-206, which has two fewer neutrons in its nucleus, of course. By analyzing published data on lava samples, Huang and his colleagues have now shown that this chemical difference also exists in Samoa and the Marquesas. The plumes feeding these island chains, as well as Hawaii's, apparently tap a single massive reservoir that underlies much of the central and southern Pacific. This reservoir contains chemical signatures of ancient rock that plowed into the interior eons ago through plate tectonics. As a plume rises, it carries part of this material with it. The new work shows how surface volcanoes may be linked to deep sources of magma, says geochemist Albrecht Hoffmann of the Max Planck Institute for Chemistry in Mainz, Germany. A few other scientists have also questioned the existence of mantle plumes, which we talked about on the show also. But the new work strongly suggests that these, at least particular hotspots, are actually mantle plumes that ascend from the lowermost mantle. Huang's group is now checking other Pacific island chains to see if they too show the same two-faced nature. And of course, this is very important. We're considering all of the geophysical changes and craziness in the Pacific Rim right now. So very important study, and we'll keep an eye on that, just like we do with everything else, and bring it directly to you. And speaking of the environment, let's take an energy lesson from panda poop. Yep, I said poop. P-O-O-P. When most people think of giant pandas, they picture cute black and white bears from China that eat bamboo. Scientists from Mississippi State University, however, are interested in what the bears leave behind. their poop. Ashley Brown, a biochemist at the university, says panda poop may point to a new way to turn grasses into fuel. Bamboo is the largest type of grass, and it makes up most of the panda's diet. Plants like grass absorb energy from the sun, and scientists like Brown are looking for ways to use that energy. At a recent meeting of scientists in Denver, she presented her research showing how panda poop could inspire a new way to get energy from plants. Plants are a renewable energy source, of course, which means we can renew them by growing more to replace the ones we use. The plants that are used as an energy source are called a biomass. Now, most energy we use from non-renewable sources are also called fossil fuels, and we know that that's a bit of a issue. Fossil fuels include coal, oil, and natural gas. They come from fossils, which are the remains of organisms that lived a long time ago. They're non-renewable because once they're gone, there's really no way to make any more, even though some people have tried. It's been a iffy situation there. Burning biomass is one way to capture its energy, but scientists want to find other ways. Brown hopes that panda poop can teach scientists something about breaking down biomass. Pandas, or at least the microbes in their stomachs, are very good at getting energy out of bamboo. Unlike cows, which use four stomach chambers to digest large amounts of grass, and conversely, pandas only have one chamber. Bamboo comes in and poop goes out. That means anything residing in there in the stomach to break down woody material has to be very efficient. Candace Williams told this to Science News. Now, Williams is a graduate student and worked with Brown on the project. Every month for 14 months, Williams counted bacteria in the poop of two pandas, Yaya and Lili, who live at the Memphis Zoo. Her studies turned up 12 species of bacteria that break down biomass, including one that has never been found in pandas. Brown and Williams say that is because the poop contains bacteria that break down biomass. It could be used to break down other types of biomass. We're taking refuse, which is panda poop and the microbes that live there, and trying to break down another form of refuse, Brown told the news. So refuse, of course, is another word for waste. Brown says that she wants to take one kind of waste, poop, and use it to break down another kind, biomass. Now, the scientists are taking the next step in figuring out how the microbes work. Brown's team is hoping to identify the chemicals that help with the process of breaking down biomass. If those chemicals can be made in the laboratory, they could be used to convert biomass, like grass or other plants, into fuel. Brown says she doesn't mind handling panda poop. It's probably the most pleasant fecal material to work with, she told Science News. Candace and I have worked with other poo, and we can assure you it has a fairly pleasant smell associated with it. So on that note, it's signaling the end of Savage Science Radio once again. The end of the pandas and the end of the show coincided this time. And I would like to take the time to thank Nick Palucco for the fantastic show graphics, Dennis Bond and Hawk Productions for that fantastic intro that I use each week, getting us revved up for the show, and Waleed Al-Haddad, who helps me find fantastic shows every single week to bring to you, and Todd Sheets, my great executive producer, who does all the magical technical stuff that brings you what is Savage Science Radio. Until next week, please have a great week. Keep your powder and your pants dry, and happy trails to you.
Times are strange, here I come, but I ain't the same. Mama, I'm coming home. Time's gone by, seems to be, you could have been a better friend to me. Mama, I'm coming home. You took me in and you drove me out, yeah. Lost and found and turned around by the fire in your eyes. You made me cry, you told me lies, but I can't stand to you say goodbye. Mama, I'm coming home. I could
could be wrong. It hurts so bad, it's been